listening to The Running Public.
From marathoners to mud runners, we all have the same goal. Get to the finish line faster.
That's right. This podcast is for you guys, the running public. This is the Running Public's Training Tuesday.
Training Tuesday is where we talk about training only. One topic, we dive deep, we explore it completely. It's training, it's Tuesday.
Training Tuesday.
I still have apprehension every time waiting to see what negative number pops up, and it just doesn't do it anymore. But I'm still thrilled every time.
I don't remember what quirk you had with your computer that had you in like your own Bracken standard time, but you were in your own world over there, according to your computer. Like, wasn't syncing with the satellites or something.
Yeah, it was set to manually update time zones rather than like automatically detect or something. And there was a reason, looking back, there was something I was doing where that setting had to be unchecked for the application to run properly. I don't remember what, but there's a memory, a faint memory of that. But then afterwards, I didn't uncheck it, and we went like a year and a half, 2 years of me being like 2 to 3 minutes late for everything.
It's true. Well, welcome back to U.S. Central Standard Time.
Yeah.
It's nice now to have us in sync that way.
10 seconds late for everything or 10 seconds early.
You've been earlier than normal, and I will say that is nice. I will also say thank you, Bracken, for manning the ship while I was checked out this last week. You know, I was resetting, recharging, doing another hobby of mine I love, and you manned the ship. So thanks, Running Public listeners. Thanks, Bracken, for keeping the ship going. I appreciate that.
You're welcome. We all need to check out, and I had help. Lisa co-hosted on Tuesday, and then Rich Ryan co-hosted on Friday.
I think Jess, my wife, is getting a little Lisa envy. She made a comment or two now. Like, Lisa's like, the running public feels like Back and Kirk and then kind of Lisa. She's like, I feel left out. And she didn't say it in those words.
Yeah.
Right? But that was what I'm inferring from our conversation. We have to find a way to get her on here.
Well, and she has so many roles she could fulfill on here. There's easy ways to get her in, but we always don't because both she and Lisa were very against the idea of having to do anything early on the mic because of nerves or anxiety. And then Lisa did one and it kind of greased the groove for her and she was able to do another, and Jess wasn't totally on board yet. And so I haven't pushed or asked.
Mm. Well, really the major issue is Jess is up for coming on, but she, you know, she works 6:30 to 4:30 or 5:30. And then when schedules align with family time for you in the evening, she has like a real job, with regular hours. And that's really the hiccup. It's the scheduling bit. But I will tell you what, though. So I got a little hybrid sort of taste this weekend.
Okay.
Out in the woods. I did the world's longest sled pull twice.
Which I have questions about when we get there.
Okay. But what I'm getting at is I'm at this flux or this pivot point of, do I want to pursue more road times and run and just do that? Or do I want to maybe start thinking about hybrid racing? And so I was bow hunting and I shot a deer and just got a deer and it was fantastic. And we had these 2 hour drag out for my buck that I shot. And what my body felt through that was like when it hit, like we're dragging and we're through sticks and creek and muck and it's just a mess, right? But like when it hits, the legs are going, the breath is going, my grip and forearms were going, everything at once. And it was at this point where like you had to stop because you would be moving so slow it wasn't worth continuing on. So the best approach was work hard, rest, work hard, rest, work hard, rest. But if you tipped over slightly, it was over in like a snap of a finger. It was like, we're done. We got to chill. And it made me think about what I would be getting into in the hybrid space about riding the line and not tipping over. Yeah. And the whole time it was like I was envisioning myself in a high rocks or something doing a sled pull or a push. And truth be told, I'm not ready for that type of work. And so anyways, it was a really good mind framer of like, if I'm going to do hybrid, I got to start changing things pretty quickly. And this weekend was a good jump start. Don't get me wrong. Yeah. But it's a different animal. What's your take on that?
I think it's good to have felt it because everyone watches a Hyrox event and thinks, why are they resting? Just get it done. And then you do your first one and you say, I'm going to go all the way down this sled push until the turnaround and then I'll rest. And then you get part way and you're like, I don't know. And then you tell yourself, okay, I'm going to make it 12 steps before stopping. And you start bartering it down after like three or four because suddenly you realize it's not just get it done and then recover on the next run. It's I have to stop now because if I did get it done, I wouldn't recover ever.
That's exactly it. If you chose to just keep pushing through, the amount of time you needed to recover what it did afterwards isn't worth the squeeze. The best approach was to manage, manage early, stop before it got too bad. And then your rest breaks were shorter and you were more productive that way. And I had 2 hours to practice it on Friday and I had an hour to practice it on Saturday. So I got 3 hours of sled pulling in.
That's a lot.
So I had a good chance to refine that. It is a lot. But anyways, all I'm saying is it was a good jump start if I'm going to head that route to frame, to frame training forward. And that is a different beast when you induce muscle fatigue on top of aerobic output. Had her Aura ring on, which who knows how accurate that is, but you know, her heart rate was in like the 160s pulling this thing out. It's like, no kidding. Unbelievable.
Well, and it's full body engagement. So even hiking slow isn't coasting. It's not like walking uphill slow. When you're dragging something, it's full engagement on every step, whether you're going fast or slow. So slow is just slower. It's not easier. So like you said, it's better to like work well and rest.
Yeah. So what would be your... If you were to explain to our running listeners, we don't get into Hyrox talk too much, like hybrid talk too much on this podcast. If you were to explain, and I have a good, I could explain it myself, but if you had to explain the difference in how it feels to be riding the line in a hybrid race versus riding the line in a pure running road flat race, how would you describe the difference in the feel between riding the line in both?
The feel is that it's dangerous and scary in Hyrox, and it's full of safeguards in a road race. Like they both hurt. They both hurt. There's no debating that. Running a 5K on the edge of tipping over is really miserable. But you know that if you just back off 2 seconds per mile or 5 seconds per mile or 10 seconds per mile, you're going to feel better. And that's not the case in hybrid. It's that if I tip at all, I'm really, really in trouble because now my legs fill up too big and I have another station waiting later that I can't coast. Like you can't coast the sled push. So you have to parcel it up correctly. And so there's not that constant ebb and flow of running where every stride you can use a different amount of energy. Like during weighted walking lunges or a sled push or pull or let's say burpee broad jumps, like you can't coast the jump. You have to jump. And if you do coast it, then it's kind of just a plop and you've just added two more burpees to your total. So it's just the risk reward is different because you can't really modulate second by second, stride by stride. You just have to hope that the work rate I'm choosing now, I have earned in training and I have guessed correctly. Running, you don't really have to guess. You run five steps too fast, your guts start to hurt, you gas too much, you back off a little bit and you get it under control.
Yeah. Yeah. It's like, sort of like when you, if you were doing just an uphill race, like a race to the top of a mountain or an uphill treadmill challenge, when you crack in a 5K, you might go from, let's say, 6 minute pace to 6:20 pace. That would be cracking, in my opinion, if you're a highly tuned athlete and in touch. Uphill running, you could go from a 10 minute mile to a 15 minute mile by swinging too hard or too early. And in a hybrid, or when I was dragging a deer out, it was like I could drag at 3 miles an hour and have to reduce myself to a 1 mile an hour pathetic walk, or a steady 2 mile an hour might get me there 20 minutes faster at the end result, right? It's like when you crack, I think your sentiment about not being able to coast is exactly right. It's like I think you almost have to know your body better in a hybrid fitness arena because there's more moving parts. There's more intricacies. Yeah. And so it's like, I don't know how dragging a deer out of the woods brought me to this, but I've been thinking about it a lot since. So
it's important to feel that beforehand. Because all of us that didn't get to that correct place in our Sims before our first Hyrox all got punched right in the face. And it was a huge humbling moment. And then we understood what to do next time. But you got to feel that once. Yeah. Well, I had a question for you about your drag.
One position. Oh, sure.
Why don't you have an actual sled? of some sort, like a plastic hauler sled to reduce the resistance on the ground?
It's a great question. Mostly because the terrain we were in is, I mean, the amount of trees and brush and other stuff, it's too tangled. That's exactly right. And for the portions in which it would be clean, like moving, like through an open hardwoods or a field, the juice wasn't worth the squeeze to put it in the truck and bring it. And we wouldn't be able to use it for most of the job anyways. So okay. That is exactly why. But that does make it easier, yeah. Mm-hmm. Like people are like, why don't you use a cart?
A creek.
Or you can cork.
Oh, if you just even had a child's like saucer, you could just float it and drag it better.
Yeah, that was 30 meters of a mile long drag, and that was about all it was in the creek for.
Yeah, that's tough.
But anyways, I'm back to Earth, so I'm glad to be here with you. What I missed last week?
Q&A with Lisa. She played host. And then Rich and I did a topic you and I have covered before, but from a different perspective, which is non-impact cardio, using the machines. But instead of using it for rehab purposes or to avoid pounding, we talked about using it as additional quality or aerobic work to drive more volume and more stimulus. So what we've learned from rehab and from him and a bit of myself in hybrid racing and training about the skier, the rower, those kind of things, and then using it to amplify your training rather than prehab or rehab.
Rather than using it as a crutch, using it as a tool, let's call it.
Yeah. Yeah. And not necessarily to reduce your running, but to amplify it. Like, do everything you've been doing. How do we use it to add more in?
I think some of the best in the sport, especially in the endurance realm of, let's say, hour long racing or more, almost all the best added in. Not because they have to, because they're cornered to by injury, but because they know the benefit of more time, more money in the bank. Almost everybody, right? If you think of all the greats.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And for the normal person, we talked a little bit about the idea that if you're trying to run the schedule of frequency of the pros, but you can't even run half of their volume, the synergy of the training will never really come together for you. But you can get to that volume other ways.
Maybe I'll have to give it a listen.
Maybe. I gave an episode a listen this weekend.
Which one?
The one with you and Lisa.
Oh, you did? Uh-oh.
Yeah.
What'd you think?
I thought it was good. You guys had a good conversation. But what I was curious about coming out of it was, what questions did you have for me that episode brought up? Like, what did you leave out of there more curious about? Because there were a few times she was like, oh, I'm not quite sure about that. Or she said something that I'm sure you weren't expecting or just wasn't on your radar. I didn't know if it brought up more questions for you that I can clarify. But I thought you guys did a good job.
Yeah, that was a nice conversation. I was very interested in the discrepancy between how you viewed Colorado and how she viewed Colorado a little bit. Because you've openly talked about on the podcast that when you were all in on an athlete, maybe it was tougher on the family life. And she was like, I was kind of living the dream in Colorado with the kids and, you know, having that sort of thing. So that was just interesting. I didn't know if she was being coy or maybe you just – did you talk about it since?
Yeah, we talked about it afterwards. And I guess I didn't realize all, like, the parts of – she had Stacy out there. She had the kids. She had the pool. She had the mountains. Like, she had that fun. But she didn't have me as much. And since that's all I bring to the table is me, I felt that as like the entirety of our relationship, where it was a piece of it for her, which she also acknowledged wasn't the best piece she'd ever received from me. But there were other pieces in play, whereas mine was like training and that's it. And so she's the other piece in Macaulay. And if that piece is not good right now, it kind of poisoned the well for me. Plus the stress of the financials, which you guys talked about, which was I was each year getting less effective at making it work. And so she was clear on there is that she wasn't part of the financial situation. That stress didn't affect her.
And that was heavy on you, which it would be as an emerging athlete trying to make your living that way.
Yeah.
In a sport with not a lot of funding, to say the least.
Yeah.
I found interesting the way she explained like the all in, like what it did, like how you found OCR and like the juncture in which it hit you and then how it came to be and then the excitement of the all in and how all in it actually was and the racing and just like I don't know, like eventually the new identity, I found very interesting through her eyes. Like it was even more in, it was even more engulfing than I anticipated. Like leaving the teaching job and that those frustrations, like I learned about things about you that I didn't know or expect, and then the risk of leaving all of that. I just, I found it, I don't know, more endearing. You became even more endearing to me through listening to that.
Yeah, it was a big love fest.
It's hard to do because it was. I wanted it to be a big slam fest, like a, yeah, you know, just break you against the coals, and it just, we couldn't do it with you because you're just too pure.
Well, you had talked about financials, and she wasn't able to. So I didn't know if that was something you were just curious about or if you actually wanted to explore, because I am happy to talk about what trying to make it as a quote-unquote pro runner was like, or if that's something you want to save for another day.
Well, I think not only making it as a pro runner, but making it as a coach in an industry in which any of you who now probably listen to us regularly know that we have a saturated market of coaches, and so it's become – I don't remember that many options 3, 4, 5 years ago. And now it's like you can pretty much hit up any, in quotes, pro, and they offer some sort of coaching.
Most
because
of them,
people
yeah.
realize it's an easy grab for some money on the side and all of that. And so just the transition to athlete or being like, hey, am I going to be a coach now full time?
Yeah.
You know, I went through it in my own right, like with leaving corporate America to start a training business and all that. But I only had myself.
Yeah.
You had two kids at the time and a wife, and so yeah. very different situations. So yeah. I can't imagine the pressure you would feel.
Well, it was interesting because like she had said on there, and she was upfront that her timelines are a little hazy of when everything actually occurred. But how it worked was we sold our home and moved to Milwaukee to take a teaching job there and to consolidate our lives. And we didn't know if that was going to work or not. And so we stayed with my parents until we decided, are we going to buy in Milwaukee or are we going to do something else? And by the end of that year is when I decided to leave. So we had saved 9 months of not having mortgage payments. And I had raced like crazy that year. And so my teaching salary at that time, that year, that was, I mean, a decade ago, but it was $42,000. But that year I made $32,000 as a runner. So I didn't know yet that that was my biggest year I'd ever have. So in my mind, we're saving money pretty easily. I just made $32,000 as a runner. That's between race winnings and sponsorship money. It's only going to get better when we go all in. So it was really easy financially year one to leave. Like it was scary, but it was also like, well, I almost matched my teaching salary. We're living frugally. We know how to do this. We're downgrading to just an apartment in Colorado. We're going to be fine. But then the next year, it was $26,000 I made. And then the year after that, it was 20. And suddenly, like, you can't make a family work in a relatively high priced housing market. The other piece is that Colorado Springs area has the Air Force Base, Fort Carson, and then I'm blanking on the other one, but there are 3 military establishments there, which means there's not a lot of people with roots there. So it's actually more expensive, at least at the time, to rent than to buy there. But we weren't sure if we were going to stay there. We still had our money that we had from selling the house. So we had enough for down payment on something, but we didn't know how long this life was going to last. So we rented, but rent was much more expensive than even a mortgage payment would have been. But I was like, we have the money, and I just had a big year, but each year it got less and less and less. And the cost of living, like, that was right about the time Colorado Springs was really seeing a jump in their housing. We looked at a house when I got there that was $187,500. And just this last year, it sold for the second time and it was $467,000. Now, maybe that was an anomaly, but when it sold for the first time, it was like, I don't know, $267,000. So it had already gone up $100,000 and then it went up $200,000 more after. So like the housing market was booming and I was making less and less. And then they stopped giving out signing bonuses for the pro team, and I stopped winning race, and then I started getting injured. So along that way is when the coaching started, because I was already writing plans for free for my friends, and I'd had people always ask, will you write me one? And I wasn't confident enough, so I'd said no. And eventually I said yes, because I needed money. So even though we cautioned people against
starting in,
right. But even though we caution people against starting coaching to make money, because that's a bad reason, I had to make rent. And we had a roommate at the time, and he would start the process of getting me his portion of the rent the day when rent was due, because he would always forget, and rent was high. And so Lisa'd talk like our card was declined for sometimes when she'd go for groceries, because we'd sit there and be like, rent's due today. Like, I need this. But his parents were paying his rent for him. But he would have to ask them for a check, and they couldn't get it their day of. So then I would cover his half with money I really shouldn't be spending. And then it would put me down low enough that now until I got that money back from the rent, like, we're down in triple digits here. And if you go shopping for more than, like, we're in trouble. And so it started – things got really stressful on my end, because we are having all these, you know, poor person issues. When you don't have a lot of money, you run into a lot of issues that don't exist when you have money. Like, one little thing happens, a flat tire, and a bigger grocery bill than you thought, having to repair, and suddenly, like, you're declined. And that adds a huge level of stress that doesn't exist when you just have more money in the bank. So we started hitting that. And that's when leaderboard started. And so that's why, like, I was just so all in on it, because it was a light then that I don't have to go back to teaching necessarily, but I maybe can keep trying to live this lifestyle. So that's the financial situation. My biggest year of running was $32,000.
I think when I was chasing Spartan pretty hard for 2 years or three, I think my biggest year was $10,900. That'd be between sponsorships and then some race winnings and whatever else. And I did the math, and I think I spent like $9,200 on travel accommodations.
I remember that, yeah.
Plus the extra shoes and shit I didn't need and the gear. I was like, I made almost $11,000, and I'm still, if I really do the math here and I'm honest with myself, I'm still in the hole for sure. Unbelievable, right? What it takes. And the concept, the conversation of money in this sport or realm in general, just the endurance, like the running space. You know, we talked to my teammate, Eamon McKenna, last week or 2 weeks ago, who's, and it was a great conversation. I hope you guys listened to it, even though you might not have an investment in D3 cross country and track, or my past, I guess, because we dive into that a little bit. But how little a successful Division III collegiate program, like getting paid at 70%, making like $22,000 in 2023, where the cost of everything is out of control, the money is just spread as thin as possible. I think the only way to make it in the space, for example, Eamon does some coaching with his past athletes one-on-one after they graduate, right? I think he is now helping other athletes out. Or you have to win a world championship or one of the big regional events to get that one big hit. So like, hey, you want to go out to dinner and to the movies tonight once? Like, we can actually like live a little, right? Instead of just be worried about the next paycheck going through. It's like in this space, it's a tough gig, man.
Yeah.
Even the pro, like some of the guys working, let's say at some of the farm teams, or like when they had Hanson Brooks or anything, like those guys were basically living, like these are the best runners in the world vying for Olympic teams. A lot of them are living in houses with five other guys, working part-time at the shoe store, making $12 an hour, 20 hours a week, to make everything work. And these guys are, in quotes, living the dream as professional runners, some of the best in the United States. Wild to me.
It is. It has to begin as a passion project. Now, we both firmly believe now that you can make it into a profitable business. You make a good living. Now, it took me 5 years to build the coaching and work through the leaderboard debacle and everything to get to the point where I can make a stable living for a family of five. Like, it's very doable. And each year it just gets better and better as long as you keep your reputation, you know, pretty sound and you keep providing decent training. But like, it's doable, but it has to begin as a passion project that you then learn to monetize. It can't start as a cash grab because it's not sustainable. It's just not. It's almost a recession-proof business, and yet it's not. Because it's the first thing people cut out when things get tight is training. But it also, recessions prompt people to train. So you got to have some longevity to be able to like get through COVID. COVID was touch and go for both of us for a little bit. And then it got good again because it prompted people. Yep. But it has to start as a passion project. And it's interesting to look back and see that you read the tea leaves wrong. As an athlete, as a dreamer, you look at it and say, I earned 20 in my first year. I earned 32 in my second year. I'm going to earn 40, and then I'm going to get Atkins is earning like 80 or 100. I'm going to get to that, not realizing that this is the peak, kid. Like, you're at the pinnacle. It will not get any better. Navy Federal's not coming back next year. There goes, I think I grabbed like 8,000 to 10,000 almost freebies hitting up small races no one was at. Like, there was Oddball Ultimate Athlete Games that year. Got $2,000 from that. Did Spartan Games. $2,000 from that. Like, $2,000, 12 times a year, adds up pretty quickly. But those 12 are gone next year. How do you replace that? You can't, especially when you're not good enough. So reading the tea leaves correctly is very important for going all in on an athletic pursuit or just being okay with the fact that you might go broke.
And you know what's funny about reading the tea leaves? And we have not given you guys any – we have not taught you anything today yet, listeners. Sorry about that. Bracken and I haven't caught up in a week and a half. But talk about reading the tea leaves is like – we started this in 2020, a month before lockdown, 2 months mm-hmm. before lockdown. We didn't know. We didn't read tea leaves. You know, we had gotten very lucky in hindsight.
Yeah.
So there were no tea leaf reading. And now we have a few hundred on the running public plans and we're able to reach more people that way. But like that wasn't, there were no tea leaves. That was just like turning over the right rock you didn't even know needed to be turned over. We got lucky there.
Yeah, and I like to think that it's because it stemmed from our passion. We were determined to
100%
do more in the running realm, whether people listened or not. We had no plan to monetize it early on. It was just we love this thing. And I think that's the important part. It's why I wanted to hone in on what it really was like trying to make it running, because it's important for people to realize that you love the thing you're doing. Like, if you love someone enough, you're there for poorer and for sicker and even poorer, and then even poorer than you mm-hmm. realize you could be. And then you still stick with it. Like, everyone has an emergency shoot you can pull. There's something you can do. Like, the hand was on the handle, but I never wanted to leave the running space more than I wanted the security of the easy out button. So it's just important to realize, I think, how much these people that you see doing these things truly love what they're going after.
Yep. Yeah. And most are living on table scraps.
Yeah. I mean, whether even my big like year,
know that or not,
32,000 was the most that any runner I knew outside of OCR made post-collegiately as a runner. And we know guys who have run for small pro teams, who have run at Olympic trials. We know people who have been national champs. None of them made more than that because running is table scraps. I lucked into Reebok and Spartan. That was huge. And 32,000 is really, really close to, I guess I don't know the number this year, but at the time, 32,000 would have been really close to the poverty line for a family of four. Like, I was
probably
psyched.
Was.
About 32,000, but you're barely mm-hmm. scraping by. It's just not running is not a financially motivated endeavor up front.
Too bad people don't pay like $200 a ticket to come watch like your local church 5K. There's so much money in it.
Yeah.
It just doesn't exist.
It's interesting. It's too bad you can't choose what you're good at.
Why is the world not interested in watching me run in circles, you guys? I don't understand. Why don't you pay big bucks for this live streaming you get, you know, and all that? Paywalls. Guess we're gonna have to start a paywall picket. Get them going up so everybody can that money can filter right into your bank account for all of your races coming up.
But I think it puts in perspective people's reactions at the finish line when you realize what they have on the line. It puts in perspective their emotions at the line.
I mean, without the money, then add in the money and you can see why.
The people who have sacrificed their lives for that moment.
Yeah. Not only their lives, but there's other people who pay the prices of your pursuits as well. And that people don't talk about as well. Anyways, do we need to stop down this hole?
I suppose so,
Okay, well, I'd like to get a half an hour of a Q&A in.
Let's do it.
Because we still got questions that we got to get figured out. Are you cool? Anything else you want to talk about? I mean, money-wise?
I think that was it. It was the biggest thing you didn't get answered for you on that. Because she did a really good job addressing her side of everything, but she wasn't a part of that process.
I didn't want to pry. When it comes to that, you kind of got to tiptoe around with, you know, that with some people. So
I'm an open book.
Let's start out with a long question.
Ooh.
How's that sound?
Okay.
Marcus Borman took two screenshots to get this whole one in. So, and he at the end, he says, also, if you feel like this is too specific or nuanced, we can set up a consult call and I can pay you for this. So just know what you're getting into here.
You're welcome,
Marcus.
He says,
you know, this is a serious question. You're welcome, Marcus. On the house, brother. You know, this is a serious question because it's an email, or maybe that's just how I justify being long-winded. I am racing the Arnold Pump and Run at the beginning of March, which I'm a big fan of this already, right?
You're familiar with this?
Read this one. Oh, yeah. I ran a pump and run.
Oh, okay.
That we put on at the gym I work out of.
I didn't know that.
Anyways, yeah, a decade ago. But I'm racing the Arnold Pump and Run at the beginning of March, which you have stated interest in this event in the past. And I would love to see you compete, especially now crossing the 40 barrier. You only have to bench 90% of your weight, blah, blah. Anyway, outside life factors caused me to deload running over the past 2 months, going 3 weeks without a run, and been doing a 40-minute run once or twice a week since. Basically, hasn't run much. I expect that the current trajectory, my lifting goals will be met in 8 weeks, leaving me 10 weeks to get my running back on track. Is this enough time to sharpen and get close to 95% of my 5K time, or have I lost too much? Should I change anything? Cut out running altogether to improve lifting more to try and shorten my 8-week lifting time frame? Go harder into running sooner because maybe it was just taking a break that reset my body to improve lifting? Is there any truth to any amount of running sends the signal to the body to focus less on strength development? If my running should stay lower, what kinds of runs should I be doing during this period? Currently, half have been at or below lactate threshold, half have been aerobic threshold. Basically, what he's saying, I took a breather from running. My strength gains are going through the roof right now, but I'm behind on my running, and the pump and run requires both. What do I do?
First of all, a hybrid athlete
could ask themselves the same thing.
Yes. I'm going to describe the pump and run first, just the parameters so that people understand what we're talking about. Even if no one else has interest, there's going to be one person who hears this and thinks, I think I'm going to try that. So pump and run happens at generally the Arnold Fitness Expo or something like that. But you bench press your body weight for max reps and then you run a 5K. And there's a scoring system that every rep you get knocks a certain time off your 5K or vice versa, adds time to it. It's a combined score between your body weight reps and the 5K. I'm doing a bad job on the scoring, but it's a really interesting.
I believe this happens the weekend of the Arnold Classic.
Is that what it is?
Bodybuilding competition. I think it's in conjunction at the expo that's before, I think.
Is that in Ohio?
The bodybuilding show. Anyway, so it's got a lot of – yeah, Ohio somewhere. Anyway, sorry to continue.
No, that's it. Just that you have to bench press your body weight for max reps and then run a 5K all out. That's what he's looking for. And so his benching is getting way better, but he wants to know, how do I best use 8 to 10 weeks to run a 5K?
Mm-hmm. Is it just bench pressing?
Yeah.
Is that it? Are you sure on that?
That's the classic pump and run. Now, in the years since I've last paid attention it may have been different.
For our pump and run, it was a, not Murph-esque, but it was pull-ups, squats, and bench press is what we had done. You going to look it up real quick?
I am, yeah. While you start talking about...
And then we
did
a two-mile run.
About how you would use your running time.
Truth be told, I would be using some sort of session each week where you're actually doing the exact thing that race day is going to require. It's a weird combination of going to complete fatigue and vasodilation in the upper body and then having to go and get the legs to work. I would practice that transition once a week, whether it's benching to failure or benching sets of 10 and then running a quarter mile and like literally just emulating. If you're really going all in on this thing, which I think it's did you find out what it is, by the way?
Yeah, it's just bench and run.
Is it exactly what you thought?
And every lift rep reduces your run time by 30 seconds up to a maximum of 30 reps. So you can cut 15 minutes off your
life. So hypothetically, if you could run a 15-minute 5K, you could score a time of zero.
If you could bench your body weight
30
times. If
you ran 15 minutes flat. You could come with a score of zero.
Yes.
0 minutes.
Yes.
And 0 seconds. I would create wads where you go back and forth, at least so that transition happens well. And then on top of that, let's say a Tuesday bench run session, which is such a weird, nuanced session to put into your plan. I would also then couple that with a lot of threshold work, like your quality long runs and things like that.
I just do want to say that for the Arnold, it is not drop and run. There's a bench starts at 6:30 a.m. and the 5K starts at 10:30. So you could end up having hours in between.
Oh, it's not a drop and run.
Not a drop and run. Not
touch.
Well,
that changes everything.
Yeah. Yeah.
God, I would do like heavy 5x5s in training And I would overstress that stimulus once a week, and I would probably do an endurance session the second time each week, and then I would train classically as a 5K-er. I think you don't need to do a long run any longer than 6 to 9 miles, as long as you hit some quality threshold and in there. If you can't run too much mileage, if you can hit 30 miles a week, great. I don't know. That's what I mean. I'm broad strokes, but what do you
think? Yeah, I would train in a vacuum. I would train the best possible high rep lifting program designed to give you high reps in a bench. I would just choose the very best one and do that every single morning. And I would do my runs afterwards. I would go into every single run having had the lifting be the main mover. And I think that's how you emphasize the strength gains that you're going to make. I don't think there's any real truth to that myth that any amount of running sends a signal to your brain to not focus as strongly on strength. Just don't think there's any proof of that. And if you look at the very, very best power lifters on the planet, they are extremely lean. At like the Olympics, we're talking Olympic powerlifting. Most of them are very lean in order to maximize their strength to weight ratio. And you can only get that way through cardio. And so I don't think there's a magic switch that happens when you are on the elliptical and then start jogging. Like, oh, you left the elliptical. Now we stop getting stronger. I don't think that's a thing. So I would, though, however, limit my running volume. I would do minimum effective dose on runs, and I would really prioritize getting good at just the 5K running, like that pace, that effort. I'd still stick with threshold for as long as possible, but then I would sharpen down, yeah.
Yeah, I don't think you want to be running too much. I mean, the one extra rep gives you 30 seconds. So there is a heavy emphasis on being able to maximize your strength gain. So I'd probably be on like a 4-day-a-week run plan and a 3-day-a-week lift plan, maybe combine two in one day so you get a day off. And I would cap my long run at 8 miles only once a week, whatever that includes, quality or non-quality. And I'd hit probably shorter volume between then, but just make sure that you're hitting the right energy systems, getting some true quality threshold. I think that's exactly right. Your goal should be to get as close as possible to that 30 reps. That I think is priority number one.
Yeah. So I'd probably have a 4-day split.
Do you think you could do it? What are you weighing right now?
180.
How many times do you think you could bench 180 right now?
Right now? I think I'd be lucky to get 15.
15. That'd be good. Be a good number.
My goal would be to hit 20 on race day. If
you
focused on it,
you think you could get up to...
If I had 8 to 10 weeks.
I think he said you only have to go 90% of your body weight if you're 40 or older, and I'm 170, so I could, that would play to my favor. I'd get close. Yeah. I'd get close, but I wouldn't get it. Yeah, I don't think.
At my absolute best, the year before, so I ran 16 flat the year I benched 275. So I want to say that on that day, and I weighed 170 at the time, probably 169, 170. So at 170, I probably could have got 20 reps right there that day at 16 flat. So that would put me at a 6-minute score. Wow. And I think you have to be under that to be any good at it. But I think I could have pushed at that time because I was bro lifting a lot that year. I think I could have pushed 25 reps probably that day. I mean, within like 6 to 8 weeks at that fitness.
I wonder what the typical winning time is when it's all factored in.
When I was looking at it, the guy who
and
won
I have to,
that year ran like 1550 and did like 20 some reps of his body weight. Very impressive stuff.
I imagine that doesn't tailor the bigger fellas. I imagine that tailors the 180 pounders and below who are really strong for their size. You're not going to have a 200 plus pound guy. He's just not going to be able to make up that time in the in the run. It's going to cater that like 160 to 180 pound guy who's really lean, dense, and strong. Mm-hmm. It's just going to,
I think the takeaway here is that how long would it take you to drop 30 seconds in a mile? I mean, in a 5K versus how long would it take you to gain one more rep on the bench press? And that tells you all you need to know about how to train for this.
Evan Erick says, possible Q&A. I have really sensitive eyes to both light and wind. Doesn't take much for them to water. I've spent decades looking for the perfect pair of sunglasses to wear while running and am still looking. I feel like once I start sweating, I am holding my ears back trying to keep them on my face. Almost gives me a headache. Takes them off, then my eyes start watering so bad it's hard to see. Usually not a huge deal unless I am bombing down a hill. Any recommendations to help this crybaby downhiller? Thanks.
I understand the eyes watering thing, and I don't have sensitive eyes. Downhill in the cold, instant tears to my eyes. I'm confused about the not keeping the sunglasses on his face approach. Like they make sports sunglasses designed for volleyball players and cyclists and dynamic athletes who are moving and shaking and sweaty. So if they can't stay on, I mean, he says decades, so I assume he's researched this and he's tried sports style mm-hmm. sunglasses with rubber grips on them, which means your only options left are to get some sort of band in back that secures the glasses to your head, or you get polarized open water swim goggles and you're going to look like a huge nerd, but they're going to stay put and they are not letting anything into your eyes.
Yeah. They make like a elastic strap that you stick on the end of the sunglass.
Mm-hmm.
What do we call it? Handle? Ear handle. What do you call that?
I feel like we should know this, but I don't wear sunglasses really ever, and it's not my area of expertise. What is that?
The ear handle. I don't know what that is. But anyways, the arm of the sunglass. Anyways, and it sticks on the end of that, and then it can, you know, elastic to the back of your head, kind of like a snowboarder ski glass would do, right? Mm-hmm. What is it called? Did you look it up?
I have the Learn the 9 Essential Parts of Eyeglasses. Temples. This claims it's called Temples.
They're called Temples?
I'm not buying it.
No, it's ear handle. Anyways, so that would be a good fix, I think.
This one says arm.
When it's been bad, I have gone, oh, arm.
The industry doesn't know, Kirk.
Anyways, no, we know. So I think that the banded approach would be good. I've worn ski goggles, my snowboarding goggles, and they work amazing. They're amazing if you can tolerate looking like a jank, yeah. Otherwise, I think maybe you just haven't found the right glasses. I hate to say it, but that's what I feel. Like maybe you got to just, I don't know. You get what you pay for with glasses. I hate to say it, but you do.
Yeah. Yeah. And if we're talking cold weather, you can secure the glasses into a hat. In fact, I just bought a smart wool beanie, Kirk, for winter running, and it has a slot for your sunglasses to enter into the hat. Genius.
Oh,
it's really nice.
Genius. We are not being helpful here. I am sorry.
Open water swim goggles. There you go.
Yeah, and the thing is they won't fog. They shouldn't fog up on you because no perspiration or breath is getting in there. So you should have a clear lens. Like with the snowboarding goggles, they stay clear on me because none of the condensation from your breath gets in there. I assume it'd be the same with the swim goggles. Yeah.
Yeah, and swim goggles form a seal, so nothing can get in there unless the seal is broken. And the open water just have wider lens so that you can sight on the skyline. So you could just carry those for the descents and wear your normal ones regularly. I don't know. There's
unless
someone,
you're a big
someone
eyeball
out there.
Sweater and they might fill up.
That's true. Someone out there is an expert on this and they will reach out to us.
Please do. We're drowning here. All right. Scott Lurg for Q&A series. I do enjoy hearing my name read, so hashtag Team Kirk. Suck it, Bracken.
I'm cutting your name out of this, Scott. I'm going to edit this out.
Scott Lurg asks, can you guys discuss the new Spartan series? Thanks.
Kind of. We have the
Did you already do this on Race Brain?
Yeah. So go back to 2 episodes ago on Race Brain, and you're going to get all you could ever want to hear about us blabbering on about the new series. But here's the cliff notes. They are getting rid of the 3K series. They are combining.
Thank God.
They're combining the age group and the elite heats together into one staggered start, like a marathon corral. There's wave 1, wave 2, all the way back to like 5. And it's self-seeded based on how fast you can run. But there is no elite versus age group wave for a normal race. And whoever the overall winners are, just like a road race, get pulled out of age group standings. So then the next up are your age group champs. However, at the national series and the regional and world championships, there is a standalone championship wave, and there's going to be some form of qualification into that. There's going to be a 3-race series for our national series. It's supposedly a sprint, a super, and a beast. And then supposedly a regional championship will happen at the conclusion of the series rather than in the middle. And then that will lead to world championships. Allegedly, there's rumors that there's going to be a short-distance world championship at a different location than Abu Dhabi, but we don't know what short-distance means. And they're talking about keeping 3K events on the weekends of the championships, regionals, and worlds, in addition to the standard race distance of that weekend. TBD how that shakes out, who qualifies, anything like that. They have not announced prize money, which I actually take to be a good thing, because they're not committing to zero. They're still trying to work on something. And I think that's all I know.
I know not everybody agrees with those decisions, but it's a handful of the best decisions, in my one person opinion, that Spartan has made in years.
I concur. In
bad decision after bad decision. I'm happy to see this. I think it's going to potentially affect the 20th and 30 somethings the most, that are really, really high end age group athletes that are standing on top of podiums. Mm-hmm. I think it's going to take away from that sector the most, because that also fills, especially the 30 somethings, the elite field in the top end. So it's going to bump some 30 somethings who are used to standing on the podium in their age group, maybe off the podiums. So I think that's the sector that has some gripe maybe with this, and I would feel the same way. But I think this is the way other high-end endurance space sports work. Yes. And I think this is a great move. I think the simplicity of a three-race series of all distances, and then going in sequential order from a regional to a world championship, would be great. Just simplify it. Quit being cute. Could we please stop changing the rules and the format every season? Could we maybe just get the same thing year after year again, so we're always just sitting on pins and needles waiting for make another bad decision? And so it's just really nice if we could commit to something and then stay there. Be wonderful. But I approve so far. We'll see how it pans out.
This is the best set of decisions they've made in years. Even if you don't agree with it, I think most people can agree that they are the logical choices to make for a running event. Even if they negatively impact you, they're best for the sport in our limited scope right now. So I think it's only positives.
Yep. And you did a great job of explaining that, by the way. So
thank you.
I don't need to add to that. All right, John Smith.
Fake name.
He emailed both of us this.
We might have hit this.
Fake name.
I believe we hit
this. Hey, guys. Well, first he fluffs us up. Thanks a lot for your great podcast. It's really enjoyable, all that, which is really nice, yeah. John. Thank you. This is coming from an old guy in his late 40s from Australia with no running background, who has taken up proper running training in the past couple of years. My question is, you often talk about incline training on treadmills and how great it is. Is this ringing a bell yet?
Yeah.
You did?
Okay. Lisa and I hit this.
You and Lisa?
Yep.
All right. Sorry. Guess if you want to know the answer to this, guys, too bad.
Listen to last one.
All right. This is from Jack Bauer, our beloved Jack Bauer.
Because Nick Riker sends us really highly inappropriate questions every time.
Yeah, but that's Nick Riker. Jack Bauer has a heart. I know gingers are supposedly soulless, but
Nick does.
He's a really nice guy deep down in there. Nick. No, Nick will do something for a rise. Jack typically stays on the rails.
Yeah.
I would do something for a rise, too. I'm a soulless ginger. All right. Jack Bauer asks, Q&A episode topic. I feel as fit as ever after having a great cross-training block for several months. As a backstory, Jack was injured with a rollerblading accident and didn't run for quite a while.
I still laugh.
However,
every time I hear that. I'm sorry, Jack.
A rollerblading accident?
Yeah. It was a serious injury, though.
It was. However, now that I've been running consistently for about 7 weeks, my running fitness hasn't really caught up to my overall fitness yet. Is that all due to not being mechanically efficient while running? My easy pace is like 45 to 60 seconds slower at the same heart rate as before. For instance, I have to slow down to an 8:45 pace to feel the same effort as a 7:45 pace before. The gap is much smaller on hard repeats, only 5 to 10 seconds slower, which I didn't expect given the large drop-off at slower paces. And it's funny because you see this a bit, actually.
Mm-hmm.
I wouldn't say this is terribly common. Frustrating, but right. Realistically, I'm not worried, as I know my run fitness will eventually catch up to my overall fitness. But I'm honestly a little surprised at how long it takes to relearn how to run again. I'm sure everything will feel normal again suddenly one of these days when I least expect it. You've been through this relearning how to run process many times, and I know it's all about being patient. Just wondering your thoughts, since I'm guessing this is common when people return to running after injury. He says, then I already know the answer, but I feel like it's a good reminder for people to stay patient when coming back from injury. I think a lot of people force paces right away rather than easing back into consistent running based on how their body feels. So that would be Jack's question.
Mm-hmm. Super common. I'm going to go in a direction I don't think you're going to go in, because I know you'll do it right.
Okay.
So if you look at how humans are actually programmed to run, it's relatively fast. Little kids don't know how to jog. If you try to make a little kid jog, it's the most awkward thing in the world to watch. They don't know how. You have to teach people how to jog. You do not need to teach a little kid how to sprint. Little kids sprint everywhere. They stand up and they sprint to the bathroom. They sprint to the kitchen. It's just the way they're wired. It's what feels natural to us. And it's our best version of our stride. And so I believe that's what comes back quickest outside of catastrophic, like, reconstructive surgeries. So yeah, being able to run at a good pace early and feel decent at it, but without a lot of staying power, is the normal, natural thing. Learning to go slow and expose every little link in the chain, that's what takes some time to build up.
Well, listen, I'm going through this myself. I have, I don't know, a half a dozen athletes taking their 10-day break from running right now. They hit a big A race, they're chilling now, or they've just returned to running. And it's like the same story over and over. And I just experienced this. I took 11 days off. I'm beginning week 4 of training, and my heart rate's just starting to somewhat normalize, yet my recovery paces are still a little slower. But I just hit a metric this weekend in a progression run. It felt pretty comfortable, and I cut down to what I might have cut down when I was, in quotes, really fit. So, like, my athletes are saying, my heart rate's so high on my recovery run, and it's like, oh my, I'm like 15 beats a minute higher at the same pacing, and why do I feel like this? And these guys took 10, and girls took 10 days off and didn't have a catastrophic injury. You take, how long was Jack off?
I want to say 9 weeks.
3 months?
Yeah.
Okay, 9 weeks. You take 9 weeks off and have to retrain biomechanical movement. You know, you weren't moving your legs in any sort of efficient fashion because you couldn't really move your, I think it was his knee, right?
Yeah. Fractured his knee.
Anyways. So you think about that, and you say an athlete who is not injured takes 10 days off and sees a 2 to 3 week lag in their heart rate data normalizing, especially on recovery runs. We'll now extend that out 5 times as long or even more and say, well, how long will it really take for those? Just look at it that way, just based on other people's metabolic processes in response. You say, yeah, I could see how that would extend itself out further. Yes, I think it has to do with efficiency. The other part is I just think, like, the whole greasing the groove thing, like, it needs to be layered in over time. I'd love to give you, like, some sort of really scientific, nerdy, physiological answer, and I don't know if I have it. All I know is I've seen it in hundreds of athletes, that response takes longer to come back. And I guarantee, Jack, if you went to run a half marathon right now, you wouldn't be where you need to be compared to pre-injury, because the stay power is going to be a little decreased, and that's okay. That'll come back. But I think for your shorter, spicy stuff, the fact that you're circling the waters already is great. Will it be harder to translate to race day? It might right now still. You may have a humbling race or two. Maybe you won't. Maybe you'll hit it all perfectly. But all I know is I've seen it countless times. And so that much time off, it doesn't surprise me. And I went worried. And you're not worried. It's just interesting to note. I didn't give any science there. I don't know if I have it.
I know that if I were injured for a long time and then I was totally healthy and you made me choose a race distance to go race, it would be a short one. And that tells you all you need to know. It would have to be short, or it would have to be a walking-based race. Like, you can't just go run steady state for an hour and just feel good at it. There's too much time on feet needed to get good at that. And that's the thing that you're missing.
Yeah. It's also a little bit... There's also a catch-22 with running slower paces, I feel, sometimes. I saw a post. Who was it by? We talk about systemic damage from recovery runs or running, like cardiac response, but then you also have to think of the structural, right? The structural, we'll call it damage from running. Sometimes, like, running slower is, like, harder on the body and can induce some sort of, like, I don't know, like sometimes you may actually pick up a pace and run a little more efficiently and find your heart rate drop. It's a really weird, nuanced thing, but it can happen. So there's, like, a little bit of that can also be at play. I don't think it's the case with Jack, but you know what I'm talking about there, right? Like, sometimes faster is more efficient and then less taxing. It's like a weird catch-22.
Yeah, whenever I do my aerobic threshold nose breathing test, I get to this point where I'm slightly uncomfortable, and then I move up a little faster, and I instantly have my heart rate stay the same or drop a little bit, at a faster pace, where it's just, all right, this is a better stride for me to use.
Yeah. It's an interesting thing. Sorry, I was reading the next question as you were talking, because I'm trying to decide.
Well, while you decide, I'm going to wedge something in here. I just want the world to know what type of human being Nick Riker is. So this is going to be not safe for work. So if you have little kids listening, now is the time to skip ahead, let's say 30 seconds. I'm going to actually read Nick Riker's question. This is one of the safer ones he's ever sent. Question, your guy's experience. What is the best butt plug to use to spice things up? Nick. That's what Nick's bringing to our running community, ladies and gentlemen. So you shun him when you see him.
What did you tell him?
Obviously, the bigger the better.
Oh, I told him a ring pop, because if it hurts at first, it'll melt a little and it'll get better.
That's good.
I don't know.
Look at you.
Yeah.
That's why we have two
ice
hosts.
Cubes work well too in that case. Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. Good. Do you want to look at any other questions he sent over the years? Or?
No, I did some of them. This was the safest one.
Do you have any that would be short answer? I have two that I think. Okay, let's just do this one more, and then we'll be done.
Okay.
Okay. I have two screenshots left, but the next one will hit to start the next episode. This is from Sam Konowich. He says, he sent me a longer winded question, and then he cut it down and said, actually use this because it's just more concise. So assuming you've done a base build and you can do all the easy and long run work you need. So you're healthy and you can put time on feet. He's saying, assuming that,
okay.
What three key quality sessions are you doing before you start your taper for a marathon? Could be a quality long run or a quality session, doesn't matter. But before the taper starts, what would be three key quality sessions you're doing before you start your marathon taper? So you have no limitations. And if you want to make this short and sweet, do it. If you want to elaborate, do it.
I think my final three would be, mine would be a progression. I would have built up to things and I would be finishing with 3 to 4 by 5K at marathon pace or like 5 seconds per mile faster with short rest. That'd be one of my final quality sessions. And I would have built up to that workout. So that would be one of them. What about you? What would one of yours be?
Without question, the 3-2 float. I would be looking to run my 3 minutes hard. I'd be looking to run like 20 seconds per mile faster than marathon pace. And for my float, I'd be looking to run 20 seconds per mile slower. And I would just weave in and out, going faster, slower, probably averaging goal marathon pace, cutting it at an hour, 75 minutes. I would probably web. That'd be like out. That'd be like 4 weeks out, 3 weeks out. That'd be a pretty big one, actually. I'd definitely hit that. I respond really well to overspeed training. It really puts me where I need to be pretty quick. Mm-hmm. So I would do a simple mile repeat session with minute long rest, and I'd be aiming to run again 20 seconds per mile faster than goal marathon pace. I'd want to be used to running faster. And then I would do some sort of progression cut down long run where I cut it when I feel like I'm racing to reach pace. And I would have, I don't know how many marathon pace workouts I would actually do. And if I were to add another, it'd be 5K. It'd be 3 to 4 by 5K with like 3 minute recoveries. Something yep. Exactly that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. What I've found with myself is that when I build to big, long races, I oftentimes feel the most prepared on the day of my last big workout. And then I do my big swing workout. And then I enter this bad zone of like 3 to 4 weeks of trying to hold it together. And because the bigger and longer the race is, the less likely you are to get the taper right and time everything. My first marathon, I am going to approach as the last big workout of a consistent build. So since it's my next marathon, like is also my first true marathon, because I've done ultras and I've done Spartan races that have been that long, but never a true marathon, I would be progressing up to a culminating effort rather than a big taper. I also have a bit of a taper, but so I'm not going to have a big, like I'm not going to do a half marathon at marathon pace, or I'm not going to do some big sim. It'll be that 3 by 5K and then probably like a 10 to 12 by 1,000 at like 15K pace or something like that with short rest, like 60 seconds.
I think we're pretty similar there.
Yeah.
I don't want to prove to myself 3 weeks out that I can do it. Because I might have just left my race in that workout.
So many people do.
You are better to wonder. I think you're better off wondering a little, but it will work if the training is right. So stop. You know, the 3-2 float, you could extend out to 90 minutes or even 75, but I'd probably cut it at 60. Because why would I race the last half an hour for my workout? Like, we only have so many of those matches to burn a year in a big training cycle. And so I think I agree with you on that. You want to work hard, but you want to save just a bit. Wondering's okay going into the marathon. You should wonder a little bit.
I think the single most overrated aspect of any marathon plan for a non-pro is the big swing last effort. Now I go into my taper. I think that's a recipe for disaster for the average person. Not that it can't work. There's a lot of examples of it working. Like, it's included for a reason. But I think there's more risk than there is reward. I just don't think it very often springboards. And I programmed that myself in the past, but I'm evolving as a coach. And so I think that's the one piece that I could do without. I don't necessarily need that. If I'm going to do something big, it's going to be under pace. And it's going to be big. Yeah. So, yeah, my last three are going to be an over-under, 5-5, 3-2, so something in and out. I really like that. Thousands, you just chose miles. I'll choose thousands. And then, 3-4 by 5K.
And just know there's going to be a number of progression long runs in there, or I might hit a tempo up-tempo long run with purpose. Like, a lot of that stuff is going to be giving me my threshold work, a ton of it, right? That's all going to be – I'm not counting those. Maybe one progression long run or progression actual quality session where I just start – and I cut down 5 to 10 seconds a mile until my body says pull the plug. And I'm going to be pulling the plug at a way faster pace than that marathon pace is going to require for me anyways. So that's really threshold plus overspeed training in disguise as well. It's just a nice balance. So I agree with you. There needs to be some grind in there. Like, people say, oh, like a 3-2 float workout. That's like short intervals, right? I'm like, no.
False.
That is a pure threshold run. That is a tempo in quotes.
Sure.
And that is marathon.
You're not floating fast enough if it feels like rest.
Correct. So those are threshold workouts through and through.
Everyone, almost everyone, when they're prepping for a big arduous race, has this weekend or this workout where they say, you know what, if race day were today, I would have nailed it. And right there, you circle that in your training log, because the next time you build a training plan, you need to know what you did to get to that point, because more often than not, they don't recapture that again. And so there's no need to do more than what's necessary, even though the race may promise to be so big and nasty that you have to do more. There's an optimal point. And I think oftentimes the race is such a big goal that we overshoot our optimal point to arrive at.
I could not agree with you more.
Nice.
I almost think an athlete should be asking for more 3 weeks out, being like, I don't know, I feel like there should be a little more, maybe, or a little longer, something that scares me more. I mean, it should be trying these workouts, but I don't think.
Go scare yourself and then get one more block of training in.
Yes. And not to muddy the waters anymore, but I would be doing uphill 15% quality sessions in here as well. I would probably be putting like a 15-minute uphill tempo at 15%, 10 by 90 seconds in the middle, cashing out with 15 by 15. I mean, I would be doing like a split tempo uphill, because the power of that for me is phenomenal. I would be translating some of these to incline as well, but we don't need to get more complicated, because that's coaching and that's nuanced, and that would be individualized. But yeah,
my take is you should be able to hit your marathon PR on any given weekend for the last 6 weeks of your training if you suddenly were given 4 days of rest leading in, and then you just sharpen down to guarantee your PR. There's not like some big massive stimulus that changes you in the last 3 to 4 weeks, even though I used to believe that.
Man, I agree with most of the things you say, right? Like, we are pretty like-minded. I don't think I've agreed with something you've said more.
Really?
In all the years, people leave their race and training way too many times, and that's not what you want to do.
And you're starting to see this at this new level that exists of these sub-pro elite runners who all their stuff is on Strava, and they are posting these crazy, ridiculous runs, like 4 to 6 weeks out, and then they underperform. And there's a myriad of reasons for why that happens. Sometimes it's they come in too confident and they overshoot. Sometimes it's that you left your best effort in training. You didn't need whatever. There was no juice left in that squeeze, but you squeezed anyway. Now you broke it.
Speaking of marathons, you see that your buddy Logan Broadbent went and ran New York this weekend after running Chicago how many weeks ago? Then races you in Michigan and then goes and runs another marathon in New York.
What did he run? I didn't see his finish.
He ran like 2:44.
Okay, because he said that if he wasn't feeling he was going to pace people.
Maybe he paced somebody. He ran 6:15 pace, so like over 30 seconds per mile slower than. But anyway, it's just kind of nuts. Like, two marathons and a Spartan race weekend all within 4 weeks.
Five,
That's been wild.
Four. That's crazy.
Logan.
That's great.
Crazy.
Good for him.
All right. Do you have anything going on this weekend?
High Rock Chicago, Jack and I are running doubles.
Yeah, you are. I didn't know if that cat was out of the bag or not.
Oh, yeah, we chatted about that. That's not a secret one.
Okay.
Individual races for a while now, you're just not going to hear about them until I cross the finish line. But doubles and stuff like that, sure.
Good luck. Have fun.
Will there
be coverage?
I highly doubt it. We're doubles. This is a major race for the year for the pro that doesn't start till noon. And we are at like 8 a.m. We're the first wave. So we're not a focus event by any means.
Okay. Well, I'm sure you can look at the live updates if you want to support your boy Bracken Crocker. You can pay attention because he'll be racing with Sir Jack Bauer as well. So I'm excited to see how that works out for you. And now that I'm tagged out in the woods, which is my other big pastime, I'm really starting to get the itch to put my sights on something on the racing front. So
good.
We're going to see here, sir.
We'll talk offline.
We're going to see here. We will. All right, guys. Well, thank you for listening. I think we're going to still have a few more Training Tuesday Q&A episodes. We got a few more in the cache. Hopefully you guys are cool with it because we'll keep the preamble shorter next week because now Bracken and I won't miss each other as much. Yeah, no promises, I guess.
Ciao for now.
See you guys.